From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we meet Marquette grad Brian Kastner, who canoed 1,200 miles through the Canadian wilderness during the summer of 2016.
Then the response of governments is key in addressing the lead contamination crisis in Milwaukee, but one expert says the general public has a vital role to play as well.
Resident activism is as necessary for arriving at effective solutions and just solutions as corrosion control treatment.
And the first generation of Italian-American baseball players were pioneers in the sport and in their families.
The Italians who came here, they brought no tradition of sports other than bocce. So the idea that their children could make a living playing a game that they considered a child's game and a waste of time was beyond them.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Brian Kastner is no stranger to difficult circumstances. The Marquette grad and former Air Force officer received a Bronze Star for his bomb disposal work in Iraq. As a journalist, he received grants to cover the Ebola outbreak in Liberia. And in 2016, Kastner recreated the 1,200-mile canoe journey of the 18th-century Scottish explorer Alexander Mackenzie. Mackenzie was trying to find the Northwest Shipping Passage through the Canadian wilderness to China.
Kastner's newest book, Disappointment River, chronicles both Kastner's own 40-day journey to the Arctic Sea and Mackenzie's much longer trip. Kastner uses Mackenzie's own writings as well as other historical records to set the scene for Mackenzie's journey and to describe his disappointment at not finding the shipping lanes he wanted to.
Brian Kastner was back in Milwaukee recently, just as Disappointment River was published. He stopped by the studio to tell us why Mackenzie's story intrigued him so much that he wanted to recreate that epic journey.
I was in the military, I'm a veteran, and most of my writing up till now, my two books, Long Walk and All the Ways We Kill and Die, are both about Iraq and Afghanistan and the wars there. And all my journalism has been about the wars, and I was always focused on bombs and conflict. And when I was getting ready to take on a new book project, I knew I wanted to write about something different. And so I turned it around and I said, well, what are the books I most like to read? And it's this kind of thing, unexpected history, history that you thought you knew and it turned out that you didn't really understand it. And then also travelogue, going on an adventure. And so I was looking for a project where it was both something that I didn't understand and I could actually go out and do something about it. That's what I've learned as a journalist and as a writer, is I'm best when I'm going out and finding that story and then bringing it back. And with Alexander Mackenzie, I found him through a Google search accidentally. I happened upon this guy and I said, I couldn't believe that I didn't already know this. My fourth grade teacher lied to me. You know, Lewis and Clark were not the first Europeans across the continent. It was this other guy I had never heard of, and his expeditions were absolutely epic. And I had a chance to follow along and canoe in his path.
And I didn't know about him either. And I felt the same way as I was reading the book, thinking, wait a minute, my history that I learned when I was in school, it's like we all learned about Lewis and Clark, and maybe it's the lower 48 that they traversed first. But he was up in Canada, into the Northwest Territories, searching for that elusive Northwest Passage.
That's right. And at the time, I should say, I mean, I don't think there's any reason why the Canadians should claim him more than Americans. When he was doing these explorations, it wasn't Canada and it wasn't the United States. It wasn't anything, actually. It was territory that had competing claims. And it was not yet decided what country any of that land would end up in. And in fact, Mackenzie, he first landed in North America in New York City in 1775 in the middle of the American Revolution. And his first posting as a fur trader was in Detroit. So he certainly has plenty of American connections. And then his history is really the history of the continent. Sure, you know, he ended up taking this river that goes through what's now the Northwest Territories, and it hits the Arctic, That's the Mackenzie River. That river basin is the second longest in North America. It's almost like hiding in plain sight. But he was looking for the Northwest Passage, and who knows how history could have been different if people had followed him the way that the Oregon Trail followed Lewis and Clark. That's really why they're famous, is because it was a story of the settlement of the West. And if Alexander Mackenzie had found the Pacific at the end of that river, if he had not found pack ice, then who knows? There could have been a Mackenzie Trail of settlers, and the history of the continent could have turned out way differently.
Why did you decide to do this in a canoe?
Well, because he did it in a canoe. And it's the perfect speed to see the country. You know, you're going with the current when we're paddling. Sometimes we're going 5, 7, 10 miles an hour. Our plan was 30 miles a day. So 1,125 miles total from Great Slave Lake to the very last island, Garry Island, which is on the far end of the delta. It took us 40 days to do it. Some days we did 50 miles. Some days we did zero when we were stuck with the wind. But I think it was the right way to experience it, because not only could I see what he saw, I could see it at the same timeline and the same pace and experience it in a similar way. And I think it would have been vastly different if I had flown into the one or two indigenous communities up there that have an airstrip and just like poked my head out and seen the trees and then got in a plane again. It was a very different experience dealing with the bugs and the lightning and the wind and the where are we going to put our tent tonight. And, you know, it's not a park. There's no designated campsite. So sometimes when you are stuck in a swamp, there's just nowhere to stop. And you really start to appreciate wilderness in a different way.
Yeah, one of the points you make, and I have to say it really kind of set me back a little bit, because I'm guilty of this too, is romanticizing the wilderness.
Right.
And thinking of it as like this Hallmark postcard of the beauty of nature, and we're going to go out and we're animals too, and we're going to, you know, and then you realize, oh my God, I have no interest in living that way.
There's a reason that we developed all the technology that we did. And I blame Thoreau for, for convincing generations of Americans about the importance and the purity and the simplicity of nature. And let me tell you, a microwave and indoor plumbing is simpler. It is not simpler to wonder where you're going to sleep. It's not simpler to wonder where you're going to go to the bathroom. Do I have enough food? Is it going to spoil? Am I going to be struck by lightning because I'm the highest point in, you know, half a mile?
Are the bears going to come?
Are the bears going to come? Keeping away the mosquitoes, am I going to get an infection from, you know, standing in river water and having these bugs eat me all day? That's not simpler. And yes, I think we've really romanticized wilderness. In some ways, it's because in the lower 48, we have killed just about every animal that might eat us. And so we go to these national parks, and all we've done is taken the prettiest places and kind of set them aside. And we forget how much wilderness and boonies and really nothing but trees and rock and bugs there would be between those pretty places. If you had to, you know, if you had to walk from the Grand Canyon to Yosemite, there would be a whole lot of nothing in between.
Yeah, and you'd be worried about snake bite, and you'd be worried about being eaten alive by bugs or having enough water.
Right, right. You know? And so, you know, that's why I did it in a canoe, to be able to get an appreciation for what was the physical and emotional toll that taking this kind of journey, you know, would have taken on Mackenzie and his voyagers and his indigenous partners, who I should say, Augina, who was also had the name the English chief. That was his Chipewyan trading partner. Augina had never been down this river either. So it was terra nova for all of them. You know, they ran out of food. They fought the bugs. It was very similar.
Do you think it might have been a little more difficult for you because you knew what you were leaving behind? They didn't have microwaves and indoor plumbing much to leave behind.
No, that's true. But at the same time, when they started their trip in June, they were already hungry, because they had wintered over in the interior, you know, up at Fort Chipewyan, which is on what's now Lake Athabasca. So they were already starving. They were already out of flour and root vegetables and fresh meat and everything else. And that's how they started their trip. And I started fat and happy. And when I was done, I mean, I lost 25 pounds paddling for that 40 days, but I put on 35 when I got back. I mean, for a year, I just could do nothing but eat. And so, yeah, I knew what I was missing. But I mean, there are towns along the way. We went 10 days without seeing someone at times. But there's also villages where we could restock on very expensive fresh fruit or, you know, stale bagels and talk to people and get a shower even once in a while. I got two showers on the trip. So that was pretty good. That was a nice break.
What was the first thing you did when you got back to quote unquote civilization?
I wanted to sleep in a bed. I could go underwater. The river was cold, but, you know, we could get in it once in a while.
And pretty clean from what you wrote.
Yeah, and clean. I mean, there's some marine debris up there, but overall, you know, the indigenous nations up there have really focused on protecting what they have. And overall, they've done a very good job of that. No, I wanted a bed. I wanted to not sleep on rock, and I wanted my back to feel better. Because when I took a shower, all I wanted to do was take a shower again. I was more sad to be done with the shower than actually enjoying it.
When did that change? How long did it take for you to reacclimate into our civilization?
Actually, I think it's pretty easy. I think that it is easy to be a happy, overfed American. There's a reason that we developed this. So I was happy to have those stuff back. You know, as a military veteran, when I got back from Iraq, and in Iraq, you know, you're eating chow hall food, which is barely food. And I remember distinctly in the airport on the flight back, there were like 47 kinds of gummy bears for sale in the little kiosk at the airport, and how weird that was. So I guess because I've done this different experience and then back to finger quote normalcy, you know, going back and forth, this time I could look forward to it as opposed to having this odd experience.
Do you think the military background and being deployed and being out where you don't get showers and you don't eat real food for a while and you're in danger, it's a different kind of danger, but you're in a dangerous situation, did that prepare you in any way for this trip?
Yeah, absolutely. I call it misery training. It's learning that when you're cold and wet and tired and hungry, that those things will eventually end. And you just ignore being cold, wet, tired, and hungry, and then, you know, go on and do your business. Yeah, I think that is great training. And when I picked the people to go with me, overall, I had two military buddies that I knew had also received plenty of misery training and, you know, would be good at that. Another friend was from Wisconsin. He lives in Stevens Point. The fourth guy, as it turns out, had never been camping. I didn't know that until we were on the water. And by the end of it, he was a transformed man.
So what do you think for yourself? I mean, the history is fascinating, and the chapters go back and forth between, you know, the 1780s and 2016 when you did this. Putting aside the history for a moment, for yourself, what did you really get out of this? Has the takeaway changed? Does it change as time passes?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a, like a big picture or a big idea, what struck me is that Mackenzie died thinking he was a failure, when in reality he was just 200 years too early. He had this vision that maybe this was the Northwest Passage. And yeah, he wasn't wrong. Like, that is a shipping channel now. There's barges on there. Tuktoyaktuk, this little Inuvialuit village there on the coast. They're talking about putting in a deep water port to service freighters from China. And of course, Mackenzie was trying to get furs to China. So like some of these ideas never go away. So I've thought it's just interesting to think about how, you know, it's not just ideas that are important, but it's also timing that's important. So I guess that's kind of a big picture. For myself, I had never taken a trip like this. A little bit of it was proving to myself that I could do it, despite, like I said, all that misery training in the military. I had not done the Appalachian Trail. I had not spent this many days continuously in the wilderness. And I'm glad I did it and got to experience. I had read a lot about a lot of the challenges in indigenous communities in the North, poverty, desperation, suicide, alcoholism. It was all of that and more. It's actually astounding, you know, the reality of things up there. And I think that's part of the non-romance as well, is seeing the way people really live. And I think that's my strength as a writer, is going somewhere and bringing back a realistic portrayal and portrait. Here is this place that we don't pay that much attention to.
Or even think about it all.
Or even think about it all. Go there, and this is what it feels like to be a person in that place and just look at it as realistically as possible and then write that up the best I can.
If you were able to meet Alexander McKenzie today, have a pint with him in a pub somewhere, what would you tell him?
I would commiserate with him. I spent like 2 years, 3 years doing nothing but thinking about this man, how he thought about things. I've read every single word of his that survives several times and parsed it out. And I can identify with some of the hardship and privation. I can identify with the fact that it took him years to write the book of this journey. He writes these great letters to his cousin about how he's trying to write, but it's way harder than he thought it would be. And he's having nothing but visions of the dead, and he thinks he's going crazy. And I think every writer can identify, you know, with that a little bit. And so I would just want to listen to him tell stories. I'm not sure that I would want to say much. I think I would want him to, you know, fill in the gaps, you know, in between some of those letters. Tell me more about the crew. We know very little about the voyagers that went with him. I want to hear stories about them. I'd want to hear stories about Augina, who is his Chipewyan partner. We know very little about him.
I wanted to know the stories of the women who went along.
Yes, absolutely. So in this party, Augina brought two wives and the voyagers brought two of their wives. And this was not some advanced egalitarian thing. It was pure practicality. The men did one job, women did other jobs. And there was, you know, as the Chipewyan said, like, you know, of course you need women. Women can carry twice as much of a load as any man. They can do twice as much work as any man. If the men are going to go out hunting, who's going to do the cooking and who's going to do all of these essential tasks? And we don't even know the names of these women that went. And so I tried to fill in as many gaps as I could, but there's only so much you can do in a nonfiction book.
Well, who knows? Maybe in some other universe, you guys will sit down over a pint and in front of a warm fire, and you'll be able to hear all of those stories. It's just that would be a wonderful conversation, I would think.
I agree.
Well, Brian Kastner, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage. What is your next adventure?
I'm not sure I'm allowed to say, but I do have a new project, a new book project, and it's also about the far north, and it's also history, but different. And I have to go on a hike, but it's a shorter hike. So I don't know if that's enough of a tease or too little of a tease.
No canoeing at this.
No. I'll be in the mountains with a backpack instead of in a boat on the water.
Okay. Well, when you're done with that one and you write it up, come back.
Absolutely. I would love to.
It's so great to meet you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Out of the night, into the water, we push the boat from shore.
Brian Kastner is the author of Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage. The Marquette grad and Iraq War veteran also wrote The Long Walk and All the Ways We Kill and Die. There is more information about him and his work at WUWM.com.
After a break, how the lessons from Flint, Michigan and Washington, D.C. can help Milwaukee solve its lead contamination crisis. Lake Effect continues with that right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It is Earth Week, and yesterday on this show, Lake Effect Susan Bentz updated us on efforts that suburban communities are undertaking to deal with possible lead contamination in pipes leading to old homes. That's even as the city of Milwaukee's health department continues to grapple with a multi-year lead crisis. In fact, earlier this month, city officials concluded that no amount of lead in drinking water is safe to consume.
It sounds like a bleak situation, but Yana Lambrinidou believes there is still hope for redemption in Milwaukee's response. Lambrinidou was a member of the Virginia Tech University team that uncovered the lead crisis in Flint, Michigan, and before that, in Washington, D.C.
She spoke in Milwaukee in March on policy solutions for Milwaukee's lead problem. First, she sat down in the offices of the Spanish Journal newspaper and talked about the message she wanted to get across with Lake Effect Susan Bentz.
The work that is happening in Milwaukee is really at the forefront
of the work that I'm involved in nationally in trying to address lead in drinking water. And Milwaukee has, I would say, the strongest and most effective coalition that is also achieving quite extraordinary change in how lead in drinking water is addressed and how it's being talked about.
So what are the changes you're hearing about?
I think that the real big change that's unique so far in this country is the transparency resolution that is really changing the way in which people are supported to think about lead in water and encouraging people to really see it as something that's prevalent, that would necessitate for protection the installation of filters. These are things that are not heard and certainly not officially sanctioned in other cities because the mantra, if you will, on lead in drinking water is that if your water utility meets federal standards, you have nothing to worry about. Your water is safe. Milwaukee now has moved beyond that myth in really letting people know that if you have lead-bearing plumbing, then you are at risk of exposure to lead in water. And this is really groundbreaking, amazingly, for 2018, that we're still just uncovering, trying to uncover the basic facts about lead in water. But Milwaukee is really the national leader in achieving that. And I wanted to support this work. I believe very deeply in having worked on this issue for over a decade that I have not seen change happen locally without it being driven by activists on the ground, not on this issue. And Milwaukee is our hope nationally because it's showing us the way, not only that it can be done, but also in what is required for this to be done well. And what is happening here is that there's a diverse coalition of people on the ground, grassroots groups and nonprofit organizations and academics and people with different expertise and different networks and resources coming together to address this problem in a united way. And I think that's something that is rare and that is bearing fruit, and we're seeing it.
So, of course, you know the recent history of your colleague Mark Edwards having been here, our mayor at that point declaring families of young children should have filters. And then there have been all sorts of complications and difficulties, miscommunications, a health department which is at a minimum in turmoil or more. So all of that aside, you see Milwaukee as moving forward.
I do see Milwaukee as moving forward. First of all, the resolution, the transparency resolution, did pass. And I also think that it's going to be pretty impossible to shift paradigms in our thought and in our practice without this type of upset in our government agencies and this type of resistance that we're seeing. I think what the community is asking for in Milwaukee is really a paradigm shift, is asking for a different way to think about lead in drinking water, to communicate about lead in drinking water, to address it, to fund it. And so these changes that are systemic, they're institutional changes, do not happen with just a signing a piece of paper. And there are going to be people who are wedded to a paradigm that is not only ineffective, but is scientifically unsupported, and have built their careers within that paradigm, there's going to be resistance to the change. And I think that this resistance is only a healthy sign of cleansing, if you will, and shedding an old skin and an old way of thinking and moving into a new one. I think it's part and parcel of change.
The conversation this evening will be health impacts and policy solutions for Milwaukee's lead crisis. So what do you feel a key bit of your message will be this evening?
You know, I think that lead in drinking water is one of those contaminants that is addressed right now by the lead and copper rule, which is a regulation that renders residents and consumers partly responsible for protecting themselves from exposures. The lead and copper rule is a unique regulation in that, unlike almost every other drinking water regulation, does not require water utilities to ensure that there is no trace of the contaminant in the water when the water reaches people's taps. This is a regulation that allows for a lot of lead in drinking water, in fact, even when lead and copper rule standards are met. And so I think that policy solutions that are effective are going to need activists and residents and people on the ground who feel that the conditions are there for them to be working together with the government here to develop these solutions collaboratively. And right now, it's quite clear that the government is going to need to respond to demands that have not yet been met, so that the conditions hopefully can be created for residents and government officials to come together and create solutions together. Lead in drinking water is a complicated problem, and it does require respect and collaboration and support of residents to protect themselves. And I think it also requires a paradigm shift in how we think about it. And the residents here are driving it. I think my main message tonight is going to be that resident activism is as necessary for arriving at effective solutions and just solutions as corrosion control treatment. The lead and copper rule is a regulation that is fixated on corrosion control treatment because it comes from an engineering mindset. We add this chemical and then we're done. And unfortunately, lead in water is not responding to that solution quite well. And unless there are relationships and trust and mutual respect and understanding that in this city, and in fact all across the country, it's the residents who are actually educating the officials about how lead in water works and what the locally appropriate and just solutions are going to be. Unless these voices are heard and there's willingness and the conditions to work together, solutions are going to be hard to develop.
Just so that I understand this, not only is the lead and copper rule supposed to be updated, right, so that there's less lead that's considered to be okay in the water mains and the laterals. There happens to be an issue with lead within the home that is something the city might say, does say. It's unfortunate, but that's your lead.
Yeah, this is a very important question. The lead and copper rule is a regulation that was created to meet Safe Drinking Water Act requirements. The Safe Drinking Water Act requires EPA to develop standards and regulate water for contaminants that are known to cause adverse health effects. And the Safe Drinking Water Act, it's quite clear, was created to protect individuals from consuming water that might make them sick. So the lead and copper rule, in fact, requires water utilities to take certain measures so that the water that comes out of people's taps has very low to no lead. The lead and copper rule is, again, very unique in that way, in that it regulates water that comes out of the tap, not water that comes out of a treatment plant or just the water that reaches the lead lateral. Water utilities, the reason they sample for lead and copper rule compliance at people's homes is because they are mandated to do so. And they need to make sure through the sampling that lead in water levels in people's homes are low enough. And I say this quote unquote, mm-hmm. there's low, you know, really the only safe level of lead in water is zero. And so Water utilities are absolutely responsible for the levels of lead that come out of people's taps inside their homes. However, water utilities have also, from the very beginning of the lead and copper rule back in 1991, resisted fiercely this notion that this rule, the lead and copper rule, would make them responsible for any plumbing inside people's homes. And the water utility industry has created this artificial division between public and private plumbing, and they have done it so successfully that this myth has been born that the lead and copper rule requires water utilities to deliver quote-unquote safe water only up to the publicly owned plumbing, and from there on everybody's on their own to fend for themselves. That is a myth, and that is not at all what the lead and copper rule says, and it's also, of course, not what the Safe Drinking Water Act ever intended. I do want to add, though, that yes, homeowners do own the private part of the plumbing inside their home, and in many cities they own the lead lateral, the part that goes through private space. That is true. But I don't think that ownership of plumbing goes as far as to say that therefore the water utility is not responsible for the lead that is coming out of those plumbing materials. And I say this, first of all, because that's what the lead and copper rule says, but also that plumbing materials, whether they're owned by a homeowner or the water utility, plumbing materials release lead when the water is corrosive enough to make the lead come out of plumbing. And so there's always that interaction between the chemistry of the water and how the plumbing reacts. To take away that relationship and pretend that private plumbing just releases lead all on its own just oversimplifies the science of lead in drinking water. And the other thing also to say is that you know, in contrast to laws that we have passed for lead in paint and lead in gasoline, when it comes to lead in plumbing, we are still adding lead into our brand new fixtures. And not only that, that our law allows for the introduction of lead into new plumbing fixtures, but also our law allows for plumbing manufacturers to slap onto these fixtures the label lead-free. Lead-free plumbing today, what is sold to us as lead-free plumbing, is allowed by law to have a certain amount of lead in it. And even though that amount has been reduced significantly since early 2014, the new definition of lead-free took effect. But still, the brand new fixtures that are out in the market and we are buying and thinking we are all lead-free can actually still cause severe contamination. And we've seen this from sampling that has been done in Flint, Michigan schools that replaced all of their fixtures. And they did see a dramatic decrease in lead in water levels. And that's really fantastic news, but they continue to see high lead levels at some taps, sometimes in the hundreds and even thousands parts per billion. So I think that as much as I think our government agencies and industries are a little bit in the habit of blaming consumers for lead in their water, and that has been going on for a little while, I think that that blaming is really not supported by the facts, because in fact, it's the plumbing manufacturers and the water utility industry, together with EPA, that have continued to allow in the 21st century, 2018, for our plumbing to still not be zero lead, and also have allowed this travesty of the label lead-free to actually not mean zero lead, but mean a little bit of lead that can still harm your child. And I think that this is really where we need grassroots activism and the types of powerful networks as the one that has been developed in Milwaukee to demand common sense and morally sound solutions. This is not going to come from above.
Yana Limbrinidou was a member of the team at Virginia Tech University that uncovered the Flint, Michigan lead contamination crisis, and before that, the one in Washington, D.C. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz in March. You can find much more of our coverage of Milwaukee's lead contamination problem and the rest of Susan's Earth Week stories at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then hear about a recent book on Italian-American baseball players from Milwaukee writer Larry Baldassaro. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Started baseball's famous streak that's got us all aglow. He's just a man and not a freak.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. When you talk about Italian-American baseball players, the name Joe DiMaggio immediately springs to mind. But Milwaukee writer Lawrence Baldassaro made the point in a past book that there are more names in the Italian-American baseball experience than just one luminary. And that book was called Beyond DiMaggio.
Baldassaro's new book goes further than that and presents the stories of several generations of Italian-American ballplayers, in their own words, spoken in interviews Baldassaro has conducted over the years. This latest work is called Baseball Italian Style, and Larry Baldassaro is with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So when did this all start? When did you first start seeking out ballplayers and speaking with them about their Italian heritage and the experience of being an Italian-American ballplayer?
The first interview I did with an Italian-American ballplayer, because I had written some about baseball before that, but in June 1993, the Yankees were in town. And one of the radio broadcasters was Phil Rizzuto. So I scheduled an interview with him, and the only reason I was doing that, it was going to be published in a baseball journal called Elysian Fields Quarterly. I had no idea then I was going to follow up on this, but thing was, the Scooter, as he was known, was such a great interview. I mean, you turned on your recorder, ask him a question, and sit back. He was fabulous. So I guess that kind of motivated me then to seek out others as they came through Milwaukee. And then at a certain point, the light finally dawned on me because I had written about Ted Williams, who was my boyhood hero. But here I am, the grandson of four Italian immigrants. I teach Italian. I love baseball. Why don't I write about Italians in baseball? And it turns out that virtually nothing had been written. So that's when I set out to write a book that became known as Beyond DiMaggio, which was the first extensive history of Italian Americans in baseball. And in the process of doing that, I conducted about 50 or more interviews with players, coaches, managers, et cetera, owners. And this is where it's come to.
Well, and I'm curious, the journalist in me read this and was, you know, really struck by how expansively some of these people talk about this part of their lives and their heritage, and, you know, comparing it to the experience I've had interviewing ballplayers who sometimes it's difficult to get, you know, a sentence of more than four or five words out of them, especially about something that's not linked directly to the game they just played, the game they're about to play, the games that they played in their past. How willing were these folks to talk about this part of who they are?
What's interesting, and this is not surprising, that the earlier ball players, and you know, I spoke to six players whose careers began in the 1930s, they were still very much connected to their heritage because they were the children of immigrants. The further removed you get from the immigrant generation, the less identity there is, especially after World War II when there was more intermarriage. People moved around more, so there's less connection to the family. So those early ball players were, you know, willing and eager to talk about their background. Everybody that I spoke to did, but as I say, the more contemporary players have less of a sense. More and more of them, I'd say maybe since the 70s on, tend to identify, and they're all, every one of them expressed pride in their Italian heritage, but they knew less about it. They didn't speak the language for the most part. They essentially identified themselves as Americans.
Right. The first people you speak with, I'm struck by the longevity that some of these guys had. You spoke with Frank Grassetti, who, yeah, he was playing in the 30s.
1932. Yeah, he started.
And at the time they broke in, it seems like there was something really distinctive about their place as Italian-American ball players that probably does not hold true in the same way today.
No, but it did. The history of baseball is like the history of America. You can't talk about it without talking about immigration and ethnic succession. So as each ethnic group, especially from Europe, came in, the Germans, the Irish, they faced some reluctance, some skepticism, some obstacles about playing professional baseball. At the same time, baseball did offer to these children of immigrants, whether German, Irish, later Italians, Slavs, Jews, etc., that baseball provided one avenue to them to fulfill the American dream, because a lot of other avenues were not really open to them. So those early players, when they did break in, like Crosetti and others, they faced some prejudice, mainly in the form of ethnic slurs, which were part of the common vernacular at the time up until World War II and a little beyond, so much so that terms like Dago and WAP, which you would never see in print today, would appear in the New York Times. It was just part of the vernacular. So when these players broke in, some fans would, holler these terms at them in a derogatory way. Several of the people that played in the 30s said that they would hear these fans yelling out. And they would hear it from players, opposing teams. However, if it was used within the ball club by other Italians, then it was, not only was it not offensive, it was termed, there was a term of endearment.
You talk about players who came of age before World War II, and so many of these players were, the children of immigrants, very recent immigrants. What was their family's attitude towards their wanting to pursue a career in baseball?
Look, the Italians who came here knew nothing. They brought no tradition of sports other than bocce. So the idea that their children could make a living playing a game that they considered a child's game and a waste of time was beyond them. So for the most part, parents were objecting. Sometimes you get the father who'd object and the mother who would support, or vice versa. So that was a sort of an internal obstacle to some of these people who broke into the game. Papa Giuseppe DiMaggio thought that he had five sons, and he wanted them all to go to be fishermen like him in San Francisco. And the two oldest brothers did, but then Vince, Joe, and Dom didn't want to be fishermen. They wanted to be ball players. Well, actually, Vince wanted to be an opera singer, but he ended up spending 10 years in the major leagues. Well, Dominic DiMaggio, when I spoke to him here in Milwaukee, said that, his father would take Vince, the oldest son, take his spikes and his gloves and throw them in the garbage can, and then Mom would go pull them out before the next game. And then when Vince became a professional and made money, and this is in the Depression, and then Joe became a professional, now Dom, the youngest, he said, my father came to me and said, when are you going to start playing baseball?
And I can't remember which player it was who his father spoke only broken English or little English at all, and he signed his first professional contract. And the father asks him how much it's for, and he says $36,000. And the father says, oh, my God, what a great country this is.
Right, that was Joey Amalfitano, 1954, signed as a bonus baby with the Giants, yeah.
You mentioned DiMaggio and the DiMaggios. It's funny, your last book was called Beyond DiMaggio, but at the same time, the specter of DiMaggio looms really large in the lives of so many of these players, right up through Mike Piazza.
Absolutely. I refer to DiMaggio as the patron saint of Italian-American fans and ballplayers. So many of the people in the book refer to him. Whether it was people who played with or against him in his era, or people who came later and talked about, how their parents idolized this man, because here he was, an Italian, after the prejudice they had faced, and he was, this huge star in the national pastime. That gave them some hope that they could succeed. It gave them a sense of pride. And this was repeated over and over again by older players and younger ones as well. Yeah, his figure looms very large.
There are a number of players who describe the scene at, you know, going into games at Yankee Stadium and whole sections of people watching DiMaggio in the outfield more than they watch what's going on at home plate.
Right. Rico Petrocelli, who went on to become a Red Sox star and sat in the center field bleachers with his older brothers, and he said, I realized I was looking at DiMaggio, and I looked around, and everybody was looking at DiMaggio. They weren't looking at the pitcher or the batter. He said that's how much of a hero he was.
With only a few exceptions, New York and San Francisco seemed like the places where many of these players grew up. And to that end, there were a couple of really influential ball fields that figure into the lives of some of these players that I wanted to ask you about. What can you tell us about Funston Playground, and that's in San Francisco, and the Parade Grounds in Brooklyn?
San Francisco was a hotbed of amateur baseball, even in the late 19th century. And, of course, the weather was good out there. And technically, I think there was less prejudice against minority groups in San Francisco, other than the Chinese, I would say, but certainly less than Italians and others encountered on the East Coast. So a lot of these kids just naturally gravitated to baseball. A lot of them who lived in what is now called Joe DiMaggio Field, which is in the North Beach Playground, where they played on concrete. That's where the DiMaggios got their start and others. And then Funston Field was just a couple of miles away, and that had several ball fields. So that's where you would go early in the morning, and there'd be games going on all day long. And that's where they developed. There were scouts there, and they signed them, particularly in the Pacific Coast League and the minor leagues. In New York, the Parade Grounds in Brooklyn was the place to play. And there's so many major leaguers who came out of there. The Torrey brothers, just to mention two. Sandy Koufax came out of there, and others as well. So those were just training grounds where you got a lot of attention. People knew the good ball players were there, and the scouts would come.
What surprised you most? I mean, these interviews took place over the course of, if my chronology is right, it sounds like about 25 years.
Right.
What surprised you most as you went back through all of the I would say tape in this business, but notebooks and notes that you took and considered these all under this one umbrella?
That's a good question. I guess for the older players, the biggest surprise was their memories. I mean, what the people in this book share beyond their common ethnic heritage is a lifelong passion for the game, whether they were players or owners. They maintain that. And the other thing is these incredible detailed memories of games long ago. And if you go and check the record book, usually they're right on target. So one example, Nino Bongiovanni, who had a very brief career in 38 and 39 playing for the Reds, and he was 94 years old when I interviewed him. He remembered when he was in the minor leagues in the mid-30s that he had a hitting streak going. I think he said it went up to 33 games. And then in one game, this official scorer took two hits, according to him, took two hits away. I hit hard ground balls. They should have been hits. He called them errors. And then so that broke my streak, and then I went on. I would have had a 56-game streak. And the surprising part is he remembered the name. I said, do you remember who? Yes, Screwball Gregory. How could I forget? 70-something years later. So that you know.
Not that he's still bitter.
He didn't hold the grudge.
Sal Bando, I imagine you spoke with quite a bit.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Sal, first as a player here, of course, and then as a general manager. But, you know, Sal was captain of the Oakland A's when they won those three consecutive series in 72 to 74. And their owner was the notorious Charlie Finley, who was very tight-fisted and lived in Chicago. He didn't live in Oakland. But Sal, as the captain, was the conduit. And there was a lot of contention between the A's and Finley because he wouldn't pay what he wouldn't charter flights for them. So Sal had a lot of stories about the give and take and how he had to be called up to the office to take Finley's calls and deal with him and so forth. And then, you know, here, the one story about Billy Martin, where Sal was the captain of the A's and Billy Martin was the manager of the Tigers. So they had a series on a Friday night. There was a brawl between the two teams. And Sal, as the captain, would bring the scorecard out to the umpires before the game, and Billy Martin would come out as the manager, and they would exchange the cards. So on a scorecard, you've got your starting lineup, and then you've got your other players, your bench players. So Martin hands in his lineup, and Sal looks at it, and under other players, he's got Rocky Marciano, Carmen Basile. He's got all these Italian fighters as his bench players. Sal got a kick out of that.
Are there players of Italian heritage that you did not get to speak with that you really would have wanted to? I mean, obviously, Joe DiMaggio is not in this book. You did speak with his brother, though.
Yeah, Joe passed away just before I started, got the idea to write the history of Italians in baseball. But if I couldn't speak to Joe, having his brother Dom was, Joe was pretty reticent. He was a little suspicious of people and so forth. Dom, when he came here for the 2002 All-Star game to Milwaukee, I was in touch with him before. He said, yeah, meet me when I get to the fan fest the day before the game. I did. He hadn't even gotten to the hotel yet. He says, come on over. Well, I settled into the hotel, and we chatted there. We went to dinner. I interviewed him. He was bright. He was articulate. He was cordial. He was a self-made millionaire as a businessman after he retired from baseball. But he couldn't have been more open. And then he said, well, what are you doing for breakfast tomorrow? So I went to the hotel. He was staying at the Hilton on Wisconsin Avenue. So I had breakfast with him, talking more, interviewing him. And then finally said, well, he says, are you going to the game, the All-Star game tonight? I said, well, I have a press pass. So, I've got an extra ticket. Would you like to sit with me? I'm a Red Sox fan.
Right, yeah.
And Dom was, along with Ted Williams, one of my heroes as a very young kid. So here I am sitting in Miller Park up in what's now the Deuce section with these VIP former ball players, All-Stars, Hall of Famers like Bob Feller, watching the All-Star game with a man who played in seven of them. I'll never have a bad thing to say about Dominic DiMaggio.
Would you think there's room for someone out there to consider the more recent history of baseball through other immigrant experiences, whether it's the Polish immigrant experience or more recently something like the Dominican or even Asian countries?
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's been a couple of books about Jewish Jewish ball players. There's a film that was even done about it. Certainly, I think as time goes by and you have more and more Latino players, there's a whole body of work that could be done there because they come from several different countries in Latin America. And now the growing influx of Asians. I think now there's about 24% of major leaguers who were born outside the United States. So this is a growing phenomenon.
Well, Larry Baldessaro, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for sharing at least some of it with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Larry Baldessaro's latest book is called Baseball Italian Style, Great Stories Told by Italian-American Major Leaguers, from Crosetti to Piazza. Baldessaro is a professor emeritus of Italian at UW-Milwaukee. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.